Now Abigail then is a little different to the other obscure heroes that we've considered these past few weeks, not just in her gender, but in the way then that she is introduced to us from the word go here in 1 Samuel 25 as a heroic sort of person. So she doesn't at first do something which then subsequently is interpreted as a heroic deed, but rather she just kind of is in herself an heroic sort of person. What's the first thing we read about her? We read there in verse 3 that she was discerning and beautiful. She just kind of has hero written all over her, which I suppose in some ways makes her a slightly dangerous inclusion in this series of ours. Because of course the real point of this series, as with any sermon series, the real point of it is to exalt God. And when we're considering then characters like Phinehas or Zerubbabel, whose heroism is of such an unusual kind, it's not all that difficult to come away exalting God. But when we're considering Abigail, whose heroism is so conspicuous, whose heroism just kind of oozes out of her, whose heroism smacks us in the face before she's ever even contributed so much as a single detail to the narrative, when we're considering her, the danger is that we end up exalting Abigail and not God. Or at least that's the danger if we handle this passage carelessly. If, however, we handle it carefully, and if we treat it as indeed we should treat every Bible passage, not as an isolated passage, but if we treat it within its broader context, I think then we won't fall into that danger. We won't exalt Abigail, we will instead exalt God. What is the broader context? Well, it's really fairly simple. Most of you will be aware of it anyway. Israel's first king, Saul, is still on the throne of Israel. But God has rejected him. More than that, God has chosen someone else to replace Saul. In chapter 13, that replacement has been described as a man after the Lord's own heart. In chapter 16, that replacement has been actually anointed for his future role. The replacement to whom I'm referring is, of course, David. And this then is an exciting time. Everything is building now towards that day when God will have his chosen king on Israel's throne. Saul may still be reigning technically, and in his stupidity he may still be resisting the future kingship of David. But everyone knows, in fact even he knows, he's admitted it himself in the previous chapter, in chapter 24 verse 20, even he knows that he's doomed and that David is going to be his successor. It's an exciting time. The juggernaut of God's purpose is moving unstoppably here towards that day when David, God's chosen king, will be crowned. And once we've appreciated that then, that broader context, we're in a position to understand 1 Samuel 25. And really then, 1 Samuel 25 represents a wobble. And I mean a serious wobble. Suddenly in this chapter, the juggernaut of God's purpose, as I called it, doesn't look quite so unstoppable. Suddenly in this chapter, it looks like things might not go according to plan after all. Why do I say that? Well, because what we discover in 1 Samuel 25 is David losing three very important things. So first of all, he loses his prophet. He loses his prophet. There in verse 1, now Samuel died. Samuel was the one who had uttered that description in chapter 13, the man after the Lord's own heart will rule over Israel. Samuel was the one who had conducted that anointing in chapter 16. He had gone to Bethlehem and poured the anointing oil over David's head. And at times then, after that, when David's future kingship looked at its most implausible, when he was being most harassed and hounded by Saul, he would go to Samuel. We have an example of that in chapter 19 and verse 18. Saul has made another attempt on David's life. And in verse 18 we read, "Now David fled and escaped, and he came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and lived at Naioth." And no doubt then, at those times when he was under particular strain and stress and he spent time with Samuel, no doubt Samuel reiterated to him for his encouragement all those promises concerning his future kingship. Samuel was David's prophet. He was the one that kept that light burning in David's mind. "I am going to be king. Whatever Saul may do to try and wipe me out, I am going to sit on Israel's throne." Samuel was David's prophet, and now Samuel has gone. He has lost his prophet. But then secondly, and more seriously, in this chapter, he loses his judgment. He loses his judgment. So I said then that Saul is still on the throne, and is still, in fact, resisting the Lord's purpose and still making these attempts on David's life. And so David is kind of permanently on the run. And of course, he's not alone. He has 600 men with him. We read of those men in this chapter. And I guess providing for them, feeding all those mouths, isn't all that easy. And so one day then, he approaches this guy Nabal. Nabal is a rich man. He has all these animals, and David has kind of been good to him. David and his men have kept an eye on Nabal's sheep and have kind of provided them some protection. And so David now approaches Nabal through some servants to ask him a favor in return, to ask him for some animals so that he might be able to feed these 600 men who are with him. And of course, he's snubbed by Nabal. And he's snubbed in a fairly humiliating way. And Nabal's response to David basically calls into question David's entire integrity, doesn't it? And depicts David as a kind of runaway slave who's kind of fled from his master. And you can understand then, this is a frustrating situation for David. Any of us in David's shoes at this moment would be frustrated by this snub from Nabal. But nonetheless, nothing quite prepares us, does it, for David's reaction there in verse 13. "And David said to his men, 'Every man strap on his sword.'" It's the only verbal reaction that's recorded there in verse 13. Probably that's just to get this point across, that basically David's response, it wasn't to reason, it wasn't to reflect, it wasn't to discuss, it was just to reach for the sword. That was how he responded to this snub from Nabal. But we discover actually, don't we, later on in verses 21 and 22, that he did say more than just that one line. And as we read more then of what David said in verses 21 and 22, it doesn't actually nuance the reaction from David. It doesn't make us look more favorably on David's reaction to Nabal, but rather it only reinforces this idea. Here is a man who has lost his judgment. In the face of this snub, he has lost his judgment. So for one thing, there's his moral pragmatism there in verse 21. That surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness. I mean, that's not David speaking, is it? That's not the David we know. He's basically saying there that a good deed like the one he has shown to Nabal, a good deed has no inherent value. It's only worthwhile if it's subsequently repaid by a favour from the one you've done the good deed to. It's in vain that I've done good to Nabal if he doesn't do good back to me. It's just moral pragmatism on David's part. Then again, there's penal disproportion. I mean, even if he were just setting off to kill Nabal, just Nabal, that would be utterly disproportionate. Nabal, all he's done is withhold his animals from David. And okay, it's humiliating and it's mean and it's surly, but that's all he's done. And David's wanted to take his life. But of course, it's more than that, isn't it? He's going to take the lives of all the males in his household, all those who are associated with Nabal. The penal disproportion is quite monstrous. And then again, there's the verbal crudeness. It doesn't come across in most of our English versions. But he doesn't actually say, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. It's if I leave anyone who urinates against the wall. That's what he literally says in the Hebrew. This is one of the greatest poets that the world has ever seen. This man who wrote so many of our psalms. And yet here he's reduced to this very crude kind of language. He's lost the plot. His judgment has disappeared. And while then we can see that just with the naked eye, as it were, just looking at those verses, we also have yardsticks by which we can measure just how much he has lost his judgment here, and which bring this out more clearly. So for one thing then, we have the contrast, don't we, with David's own conduct just one chapter earlier. Remember how there he's in a cave with his men. And who should come into the same cave? Saul. And there Saul is, and he's just utterly on a plate for David. David can do what he wants to Saul. Saul doesn't know that David's there in the back of the cave. And of course, David has been urged by his men, go on, go and finish him off. This is surely God's providence putting him here in front of you like this. And of course, Saul has wronged David far more than Nabal has wronged David. Saul has attempted to take David's life. He's thrown spears at David. He's done all sorts of things to David. And yet, with all these men urging him to do it, he will not hurt Saul one little bit. And yet now, at the slightest provocation, he's wanting to go and kill Nabal and all his household. We have that yardstick. And then we have another yardstick as well, to measure just how much he has lost his judgment here. Not in this case a contrast, but a comparison. And not in this case then a comparison with his own earlier conduct, but a comparison with another character's conduct. A comparison with Saul's own conduct. I'm thinking of what happens in chapter 22 of this book. And there, then we have Saul, and he feels snubbed. He feels snubbed by Ahimelech, the priest, because Ahimelech has helped David. David's on the run, as we've said, and Ahimelech has given David some provisions and Goliath's sword, and he's helped him on his way. And so Saul feels snubbed by the way that Ahimelech has aligned himself with David rather than with him. And he too, he reacts by reaching for the sword. And he targets not just Ahimelech, but we read in verse 18 of chapter 22 that on that day 85 priests were killed by Saul. It was actually Doeg who did it, but at Saul's command. And more than that, in verse 19, we read that Nob, the city of the priests, was put to the sword. Both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey and sheep, he put to the sword. That was how Saul behaved back in chapter 22. And here now we have David. And and he's been snubbed by Nabal. And he's reaching for his sword. And he's targeting not just Nabal, but all those associated with Nabal. This is David acting in a Saul-like way. And that is a grim comparison, isn't it? And it raises then the troubling question here in chapter 25. Is history just repeating itself? I mean, Saul had started out well, hadn't he? At the start of his reign, he looks like he's going to be this great king of Israel. He starts out reasonably well, but then, of course, he loses his judgment and is rejected by God, ultimately. Well, it's the same thing now happening with David, but at an even earlier point. He hasn't even got to the throne yet, and already he's going down the Saul route, already losing his judgment. Is he now going to be rejected by God as well? This is a very serious situation. He loses his prophet. He loses his judgment. But then thirdly, he loses his wife. He loses his wife. This is the final verse of our chapter. Michal is now, we're told there, no longer David's wife, but the wife of this other guy, Palti, the son of Laish. Now, Michal is not a biblical character who makes perhaps a massive impression upon us one way or the other, but we must remember she has two things at least in her favour. Number one, she came to David's rescue. You know the story back in chapter 19. We've already referred to that chapter, and Saul is trying to kill David, and in verses 11 to 17 of chapter 19, David escapes from Saul, and it's Michal who really engineers this. She's the one who sees the danger in the first place. Verse 11, if you do not escape with your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed. It's she who then facilitates the escape. She lets him down through a window, verse 12. And it's she who then delays the discovery of his escape by this ruse, where she kind of puts a scarecrow in the bed and it looks like David's there, but of course he's not there, and that delays then the discovery of his escape. So she came to David's rescue. Let's not overlook that. And then the second thing in her favour, she aided David's reputation. She aided David's reputation. She saw, for all his failings, he had supporters. He had loyal supporters in the land. How is David, once he does come to the throne, once Saul is out of the way, how is David going to win over all those loyal Saulites? How is he going to do so when he's not Saul's son? If he were Jonathan, if he were Saul's son, then he'd be easy. They would naturally transfer their allegiance to him, but he's not. How is he going to win over all Saul's supporters? Well, by the next best thing. Not by being Saul's son, but by being Saul's son-in-law. And Michal then, as Saul's daughter, will give David a certain credibility, a certain respectability amongst all Saul's supporters. So there are those two things in her favour. And when then we read in verse 44 that she's now gone, she's lost, it's not an incidental footnote. This is David losing this wife who came to his rescue and who aided his reputation. So I hope you can see then that this is a serious wobble here in chapter 25. David, as God's chosen king, is supposed to be striding irresistibly toward the throne of Israel. But here instead, in chapter 25, we see him losing his prophet, and we see him losing his judgment, and we see him losing his wife. These are alarming developments. Is everything going to unravel now? Is God's plan going pear-shaped? Well, no, it's not, of course. God can't be confounded. God can't be frustrated. And God has an answer then to these three worrying losses. And it's the same answer to all three. And the answer is Abigail. Let me just quickly show you then how that's the case. Let's just quickly trace her role in this narrative. Notice first of all, she foretells David's future. She foretells David's future. So I've said then that Samuel had been for David this fount of encouraging prophecies about his future kingship. And now he's lost Samuel. He's lost his prophet. Well, here he is now, and he's on this journey to wipe out Nabal and his household. Unbeknown to him, however, Nabal's wife, Abigail, has heard about this. And she has set out in order to intercept David, in order to meet him. And she does intercept him. She does meet him. And having done so, she pours out this long speech. And we might sum it up as a piece of negotiation, a piece of diplomacy, if you like. But it's not just that. Did you notice it's also a piece of prophecy? There's prophecy mixed in Abigail's speech. She prophesies of David's future kingship. Verse 30. When the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel. She foretells that David is going to rule on Israel's throne. And in fact, Abigail offers here in her speech one insight that way exceeds anything Samuel prophesied about David. What is it? Verse 28, she uses a very significant word, the word house. The Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house. What's that saying? It's saying not simply, David, are you going to rule over Israel, but you are going to found a dynasty in Israel. That's the first time this has been prophesied. This is 2 Samuel 7 language. You know how Nathan will come and he will prophesy about this in great detail. That's way further down the line. Abigail, all this time before that, she's the first person to say that David is going to have a house in Israel, a line. And as I mentioned earlier in our service, that of course has messianic implications. It will culminate in the rule of Jesus Christ himself. Am I saying then that Abigail is now the new Samuel in Israel, from whom David is now going to receive all this divine revelation? Well, no, this is probably just a one-off that Abigail prophesies in this way. But it does signify to David here, doesn't it, that the loss of Samuel is not the catastrophic thing it might appear to be. God's eggs weren't all in one basket. Samuel was not the only channel of revelation available to God. God will still give David revelation in this post-Samuel era. Whether it's through Abigail in a one-off instance like this, or whether it's through Nathan in a more sustained way, he'll soon emerge on the scene, won't he, as a prophet for David. But Samuel is not indispensable. That's what it's saying. Of course, we don't have prophets. But is there not an abiding principle there that no individual servant of God is indispensable? For us, perhaps we might apply it at the level of preachers. I think of the preachers who have massively influenced me. Jeff Thomas and Donald MacLeod and Sinclair Ferguson, these kind of men, and to a varying degree, all of them are in retirement now. It's a sobering thought. But we need to remember, don't we, that no servant of God is indispensable. And as we see Abigail then here, doing a very Samuel-like thing and foretelling David's future kingship, it's an indication to David there's life beyond Samuel. And there's life beyond every servant of God. The greatest and most eminent servants of God in every generation will end up as Samuel ends up in verse 1 of our chapter. But never does that spell the end of God's activity. Never does God's work die with his dying servants. When Samuels die, we rightly mourn, as all Israel mourned over Samuel's death. But we don't despair. because there's life beyond Samuel, there's life beyond every servant of God, and Abigail is a little indication to David of that. So she foretells David's future. Secondly, she alters David's attitude. She alters David's attitude. I said then that David, in the aftermath of Nabal's snub, he loses his judgment. He veers alarmingly into Saul territory in his reaction to Nabal. But this is the thing. He only veers. Whereas Saul did shed Ahimelech's blood and the blood of 80 priests and the blood of a whole town of priests and their wives and their children and their animals, David doesn't shed any blood in the end here. Indeed, by the end of this passage, there's only one Saul-like character in the story. And it's not David, thankfully. It's Nabal. You may notice the end of the passage is kind of a repeat of chapter 20 of 1 Samuel. There in chapter 20, we have someone closely related to Saul, Jonathan, and he has been conferring with David, and he then returns to Saul as the latter is engaged in a feast. Here, at the end of chapter 25, we have someone closely related to Nabal, Abigail. And she has been conferring with David. And she now returns to Nabal as the latter is engaged in a feast. In fact, suggestively, the narrator says, doesn't he, in verse 36, that he's feasting like a king. So David could have become the Saul in this story. But thankfully, by the end of it, David hasn't become the Saul in this story. Nabal is the Saul in this story. David's judgment has been restored, and Nabal is the Saul character, not David. And how then has that come about? How has his attitude been altered? Where is the rage gone? That petulance, that desire for revenge, that vindictiveness, where's it gone? How has his attitude been altered? Well, Abigail, of course, has altered it. She's basically altered it by pointing out to him that any rash acts he does now against Nabal would be subsequently very regrettable. Once he's on the throne, he would have that on his conscience for the rest of his life, the rest of his reign. She points out the inevitable regrettableness of him going ahead with his plan. And all of that's great then, isn't it? And rightly we celebrate Abigail. She is this hero, and she wonderfully intercepts David and alters his attitude and restores his judgment. But you know, there's something even better, isn't there, than a king whose attitude is altered by an intervening Abigail. And that's a king whose attitude never needs to be altered by an intervening Abigail. And of course, I'm thinking of David's greater descendant, King Jesus. Think of him on that night, and he's in a garden, and he's been praying. And suddenly the quiet garden is invaded with noise. A mob has turned up from Jerusalem, and they've come to arrest him. And the Prince of Peace is there in that garden, and they've come with weapons to arrest him. And it's so beneath his dignity. He's the incarnate Son of God. It's so beneath his dignity, these little men coming with their weapons to arrest him. If ever a situation called out for a rush of indignation and a reaching for the sword, it's that situation. And sure enough, there is a rush of indignation and a reaching for the sword. But not from Jesus, from the disciples who are with him. And no Abigail has to come along and restrain Jesus in that garden. Jesus, there is the Abigail who has to restrain the others who are with him. Notice the gentle rebuke that Abigail gives to David in verse 28 of our chapter. The Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord. Of course, what she really means there is you should be fighting the battles of the Lord. But in fact, David, you have been distracted and diverted from fighting the Lord's battles, and here you are just fighting your own personal battle. That's all you're doing here. You're just settling a score with your own personal enemy, and this has nothing to do with Yahweh's cause. That's what she's really saying. King Jesus was never thus diverted and distracted, was he? Jehovah had an enemy, the serpent, and he had appointed Jesus as the crusher of that serpent. And he could only do that through the sacrificial death of the cross. And Jesus then, throughout his 33 years, and particularly throughout those last 3 years, he so single-mindedly and undeviatingly headed for that sacrificial death to fight the Lord's battle and crush the Lord's enemy. And all the slights and insults of the Pharisees and the Samaritans and other people, they couldn't divert him. He didn't get caught up in his own little private battles at any point. He was fighting the Lord's battle, and he made that beeline for Golgotha to crush the Lord's enemy without the aid of any Abigails at any point. What a king Jesus is, isn't he? Is he your king? Do you know the vastly better king than David as your king this evening? So she foretells David's future, and she alters David's attitude, and then thirdly, she becomes David's bride. She becomes David's bride. Nabal dies then, struck down by the Lord, sometime just a few days after this. And Abigail then becomes David's wife. And I said then before about Michal, that she was a wife who came to David's rescue and who aided David's reputation, and now she has been lost. By the way, notice there in verse 44, she hasn't been lost through infidelity or through death. She's been lost through Saul. Saul has removed her. And he has done so, of course, precisely because she did come to David's rescue and she did aid his reputation. That's what Saul can see that. That's why he's taken her away. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because Saul originally gave Michal to David, not because he was this avuncular father-in-law who was giving his daughter to David because he liked David so much. He originally gave Michal to David in order to bring David down. You see that back a few chapters earlier, there in verse chapter 18, we read in verse 21 that Saul, in verse 20, that Saul gives Michal to David. Verse 21, Saul thought, let me give her to him that she may be a snare for him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul's thinking, if he's married to Michal, then that will make him more of a target for the Philistines. He gives Michal to David in order to bring David down, and yet now he's withdrawing Michal from David in order to bring David down. And in that, don't we see, in that tactic by David's enemy Saul, don't we see one of the tactics of the enemy, Satan? That he makes U-turns sometimes, doesn't he? He changes his strategy completely. At one point, it's in Saul's advantage to attack David through giving Michal as his bride. At another point, it's in Saul's advantage to attack David by withdrawing Michal. And Satan makes those kind of U-turns with us, doesn't he? At one point, he will try and get us through financial difficulty, to get us to succumb to anxiety and self-pity. At another point, he will get at us through financial plenty to try and induce us into complacency and self-indulgence. At one point, he will try to make us wild-living hedonists. At another point, self-righteous moralists. At one point, he will tempt us with heresy. At another point, with hair-splitting, lifeless orthodoxy. He's so versatile, he'll change his approach. And we see something of that then in Saul toward David. But this is the point then. As David then, having lost Michal, now marries Abigail, he gets in her all that he had lost with Michal. She's as much as a rescuer as Michal had been. Isn't that what she's doing in this passage? She's rescuing David. Okay, Michal had rescued David from a physical danger, Saul, who was coming to kill him. Abigail rescues David from a moral danger. He's losing his judgment. He's going down this route of sin. He's going to wipe out Nabal. And she rescues him from that. Which reminds us, by the way, doesn't it, that sometimes God's people need Michals to rescue them from physical danger. Paul had Michals, didn't he? His nephew was a Michal who rescued him from physical danger when the Jews were going to ambush him. Those who lowered him in a basket out of Damascus were Michals who rescued him from physical danger. Sometimes God's people need Michals, but sometimes God's people need Abigails to rescue them from moral danger. Peter needed an Abigail in the shape of Paul when he was starting to go back to Jewish food regulations in the presence of Gentiles. He was withdrawing himself from the Gentiles, and Paul had to stop him. He was losing his judgment. Thank God when, yes, he sends a Michal, but thank him when he sends an Abigail to rescue you when you're losing your judgment. Perhaps you know Abigails in your life who have done that. So Abigail, she's as much as a rescuer as Michal is, but also she aids his reputation as much as Michal did. When David finally did become king, where did he first establish himself as king in Israel? It wasn't in Jerusalem, of course. It was in Hebron. You can read of that in 2 Samuel 2. Who lived in Hebron? The descendants of Caleb lived in Hebron. Joshua 15, verse 13, remember, Hebron was given to Caleb and his descendants. Why then were the Calebites in Hebron the first supporters of King David? Well, could it not be because Nabal was a Calebite? We read that, don't we, in the start of our passage. And the Calebites then probably never knew that David at one point was trying to wipe out one of their families, Nabal. But the Calebites the Calebites would have known that David ended up marrying Abigail, the widow of one of their own people, Nabal. And that gave him credibility amongst them. Like when I go to the Banner of Truth Ministers Conference and I'm sitting next to a Welsh minister and there's polite conversation until I mention that I have a Welsh wife, and then suddenly I'm this VIP in their eyes. And so David then would have been given credibility in Hebron because Nabal's widow was now his wife. And you see then that, yes, Michal, with all her advantageousness for David politically, she'd gone, but now he has Abigail. And she can provide the same thing. When God is for you, even the cleverest stratagems against you won't work. This was clever of Saul to withdraw Michal. This was much cleverer than hurling a spear at David. This was clever stuff. But God was for David. And Michal was out of the equation, but he had Abigail lined up to replace him. So I hope you can see then that when we put 1 Samuel 25 in its broadest context, and we see that this is an apparent wobble in the unfolding purposes of God. And we see then that Abigail is God's means of addressing these alarming developments. We don't come away exalting Abigail. But this God who has Abigail's up his sleeve, this resourceful God who's never outwitted, never fazed, This God who isn't panicked by David losing his prophet and his judgment and his wife, but he just throws Abigail into the equation and everything's fine. What a God we have. And as then we were reminded this morning, don't we live in a world where so often God's purposes seem to be wobbling? As we said, David had a greater descendant, Jesus. Jesus is now on the throne. And God's purpose now is that Jesus should reign wherever the Son doth his successive journeys run. That Jesus should have this worldwide kingdom of men and women and boys and girls. And that purpose, it seems to be wobbling often, doesn't it? As we see rampant Islam, as we see in our own society rampant secularism, as we see all these forces lined up against God's purpose, we think, well, is it wobbling? Is it unraveling? We're often in 1 Samuel 25. But we have the same God. The God who has Abigail's up his sleeve. The God who is never bamboozled. Don't lose your hope and your confidence in this God. And lastly, with regard to Abigail, we don't want to go away exalting her. And I trust you've seen we come away fundamentally exalting God. But Abigail, she was discerning and beautiful, but she was also Nabal's wife. And that can't have been much fun. He was a surly and a mean man. And Abigail could well have thought, couldn't she, that my circumstances are so depressing, I can never be of any use to God. If only I had a different set of circumstances, then I could be so fruitful, but here I am and I'm yoked to this guy who's such an idiot. But if she thought like that, she was wrong, because she was vastly useful in the purposes of God. And perhaps you have a Nabal in your life. Perhaps it is a spouse. Perhaps it's your job. Perhaps it's your health situation. And you say, if only I didn't have this Nabal, then I could be so useful and fruitful in the service of God. Just like those Corinthian believers might have said, if only we weren't slaves, we could be so useful. We need to stop being slaves. And Paul says, no. No, you don't need to change your slave status. You can serve God in your slavery. And Abigail could serve God married to a fool like Nabal. And you can serve God in that job of yours that's so mundane. And in that set of circumstances that seems so constricting and limiting and restraining on you. Be encouraged that whatever our circumstances, we can be fruitful in the service of God. Amen.